who talks about 100 years out? Mm-hmm. I mean, we talk in 5, 10, 25. One of the most beautiful things about being part of a family business is that we have that 100-year-out view.
Hi, I'm Luke Hanson McDonald, and welcome to Beyond the Family Business. Hi, Luke Hanson McDonald here. Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Family Business. Today we have an interview with Leslie Bishop. She's a fourth generation member of one of the most prolific family businesses in Canada, the Jodry family. The family business story starts with R.A. Jodry, an incredible industrialist here in Eastern Canada, who lost his fortune and then remade his fortune all in a lifetime. Leslie explains this element of the family history, as well as how the business has evolved over the last five generations. She explains her own journey working outside and then inside the family business, and some of the very complex but necessary structuring that they put in place to ensure an engaged family without hindering the success of their business leadership. If you're interested in family office structuring, this is a very interesting episode for you. So please enjoy. I have four questions to start off.
Okay.
Who are you? Where were you born? Where do you live? And what do you do?
So my name is Leslie Bishop. I was born in the Annapolis Valley, Nova Scotia, in a small community called Gaspereau. I was born at the Wolfville Hospital, which doesn't exist anymore. I currently live in Halifax. And what do? That's a great question. First and foremost, I'm a mom. I have three children. And I work in a family business that my great-grandfather started.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I think we're going to get into that. So the question I always ask everybody at the start, what does family mean to you?
It's a great question. For me, family is, I would say, the ultimate connection. So an understanding both of who I am and where I belong in the world. And it is the route in which guides me when I am unclear, and also the freedom to manifest a lineage in the way that is true for myself.
Mm-hmm. That sounds profound. Love it. The thing that I love about this question, especially when I talk to somebody like you, and you're in the fourth generation?
Yes.
Fourth generation.
G4, yeah.
Is one of the things that often is said about families, especially family businesses that have been around for a while, is you always hear about the sort of toxic part and the things that don't work well. But then I love talking to somebody who's that far into a family business and still sees it as, you know, the connectivity and the most important thing and whatnot. Because it gives me hope, being, you know, in second generation, that my kids and my grandkids will hopefully feel the same way, that they'll still understand the importance of family.
Yes. Yeah. I think that is also profound. I mean, there is an underlying hope that is either conscious or unconscious when it comes to family. And as we know in this world, family looks different for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so I can really see that the holding on to what happens after me and what happened before me and who am I in all of that.
Yeah, that is absolutely the journey I'm on, trying to figure out who am I. So I guess maybe to give our listeners some context, can you talk about who was that first entrepreneur that started your family business?
Yeah, our founder. So R.A. Jodry was my great-grandfather. He was definitely the true essence of an entrepreneur. He stopped going to school at the age of 12 and got his first job.
Wow.
He left grade school and became a harvester of apples in the Annapolis Valley. And by the age of 18, he had his own company and was exporting apples to England. And it just continued from there.
Wow. Yeah. What an entrepreneur.
Yes, absolutely.
Did, so
he just blindly wanted to get into business? Were his parents in business, or was he doing it just out of his own accord?
Out of his own accord, he had that spark of entrepreneurship that we often talk about in family business. There has to be someone who's the fire starter, and he certainly was. He also knew that he had to learn, and so he did correspondence courses at the time. But didn't want to do it in regular grade school, and picked up textbooks along the way. And he was a big fan of mentorship. I'm not sure he would have called it that, but he relied on connections to learn more and was always willing to ask questions and take risks.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's interesting how many entrepreneurs, especially, from years past, didn't go the formal education route and figured it out on their own. And I went to business school and have gone that route. But it's something I always wonder. And my dad and my uncle, actually, he quit school when he was similar age. Mm-hmm. He was in grade 9 and then went on to be successful. And I often wonder, what is that balance you should be trying to strike of, getting the real world experience as soon as possible versus the formal education? What is more important, or how do you find the balance of the two?
Exactly. And I think culture has a lot to do with it. So if there is no existing culture in a business, so we look at G2, even there's a culture. Mm-hmm. Definitely for Generation 4, we have a particular culture. And I think if you look at entrepreneurship, there is a culture in which you're creating within oneself. Mm-hmm. And I think he started with that. And then bringing more and more family into the business, the culture naturally morphs and changes. Mm. And keeping aware of that, I think, is really important for legacy and continuation of a business.
That's a really interesting point. Because one of the things I've felt before with, again, the G1 generation is they kind of look down sometimes on the formal education route because they didn't do it that way.
Right.
They had that educational path, learning in the field sort of approach. But you're right, the culture's shifting, and it kind of needs to in some ways, because not everybody's going to be that fire starter entrepreneur. And, why not take advantage of learning from others in a formal setting?
Exactly. And then, of course, those who are guiding us along the way, the generations before us, are saying, look, this is kind of what we need now. We need you to go out and learn something else to come back and help with us, or to help with the company the way it is now. Because the way it is now is not the way it was when we started. So, looking at needs, I think there's another way needs sort of inform culture as well.
Yeah, okay. That's a really great point. Mm. So their initial, or RA's initial success was his Apple business, I presume.
Yeah.
But he had many other successes.
He sure did.
So where did it go from there?
Yeah. I guess after, he was exporting apples, he was a big community guy. He really believed in the the wealth of community. Mm-hmm. And so he got together with a partner at the time. He was also a believer in partnership in business. Mm-hmm. And he had the story I've heard, because I had met him once and I don't have the memory of
me. Oh, wow. You actually met him.
I did.
That's incredible.
I was one, apparently. but he had a partnership with someone, and he had read a design textbook on dams and building dams. And so he decided with his partner that he was going to build a dam in the valley in White Rock, built the dam of which he ran, and it provided power for Windsor, Woofill, that whole area. Wow. And the Annapolis Valley, and then eventually sold it to, which is now Nova Scotia Power.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
That is a crazy pivot from Apple growing and exporting to being an industrialist with a power plant.
Exactly. And so I think the stories I hear about him, people were, talk to him about, he was always interested in what other people were doing and what other people needed. Mm-hmm. And how he can service that need. What can I do to make that happen? Mm. And that's one of the things that I really value and aspire to in my own, path, but mm-hmm. also in guiding my children, mm-hmm. is that curiosity, to mm-hmm. get really curious about where's the need and what can I do to service that and how can I make money doing it?
For sure.
Yeah.
I think, you know, and I completely agree with that curiosity, because I find sometimes, you know, once you're in a business that is well structured and, you know, is stable, I guess you could say, there's a pressure to not rock the boat too much.
Yeah.
But an entrepreneur almost doesn't feel that pressure. And, you know, I'm sure anybody that your great grandfather spoke to, and, you know, when he was like, I did well at Apple's and I'm going to go build a dam. I read a book about it.
Yeah.
You know, people would be like, what are you, crazy?
Yeah.
Like, keep going with the Apple thing.
Exactly.
But, you know, he had the gall to go and do that and the tenacity to figure it out on his own. That's a very unique skill to be able to push that pressure aside and go after that kind of creative view.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's that whole idea of, you know, we take the idea of diversification as a theory, you know, as opposed to someone just doing it naturally.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm always so curious around what the difference is, like what are the nuances of, and what makes it work and what makes not work.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
One of my interviews I did recently was with a friend of mine who was an immigrant from India. And so he's G1, he's built a huge business, his brother's in the business, his parents are in, they now have kids, et cetera. And I was talking to him about like his entrepreneurial journey. And one of the things that resonated the most with me afterwards as I was reflecting on the discussion is that like, he doesn't overanalyze decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So him and his brother, they would see something that they could sell through e-commerce and they just do it.
Right.
And it would work or it wouldn't work.
Right.
And you know, they got into real estate and, you know, I was like, what was the strategy? Well, we needed to do something. We had money from e-commerce and we started buying houses.
Right.
And, you know, now they're starting a recruitment agency. And I'm like, why? They're like, well, you know, it seemed like a good idea. So we're doing it. And so it's just like the speed at which entrepreneurs make decisions and have confidence to execute is incredible, because I find, again, you know, being in a more professional business or bureaucratic business, for good reason, you don't want to be swerving the boat all the time, but it is a hindrance to entrepreneurship if you can't sort of go after what can seem like a crazy idea, but
exactly,
you know.
And then there's this whole notion of, you know, let's try this and let's try this. Well, if a lot of them are working, then you're naturally diversified. And at some point, the longer you go, which we found in our business as well. I mean, we were quite, you could call us diversified.
Yeah.
Then there was too much of a diversification and we needed to focus on our core business again and knowing when to do that and when to step back. And so if that entrepreneurship or that risk is ingrained in culture, but then you look at the strategy and what you're working with, like how do you make those decisions? So it's fascinating, especially as you get through G2, 3, 4 and we're in generation 5 right now. So we really continue to look at that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I did some reading on your great-grandfather as well. One of the things that came across was he did have incredible tenacity. And I read a story about during the Great Depression, he lost a ton of money in the stock market crash.
Yes.
But then rebuilt his wealth and then some after that.
Yeah.
Can you talk at all about that?
For sure. I mean, he worked for 40 years before he had sold that power company to Nova Scotia Power, and he took those funds and he put them all in the stock market. And to your point, yes, you know, not such a great idea at the time, but who knew?
Yeah.
One of the things that I find the most interesting about that is that he still had an operation company called Minas Basin Pulp and Power, Pulp and Paper. And it has been said that it's because of that operation that he was able to build his wealth back up again.
Yeah.
And so there's always, you know, especially in my generation in family business, this talk of, you know, how long can family businesses last within operations? Is it better to take all of that money and put it in an investment portfolio and have it managed that way? And we, you know, family businesses talk about this all the time.
Yeah.
When's the right time to do that? Is there ever a right time to do that? But in that scenario, it served him well to stay in operations, and he continued to expand into forestry, into pulp molding, which, you know, then we saw CKF come in, and that's our pulp molded products. And so it just served us well that way.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really thematically on with the diversification discussion is that our generation, and, you know, I mean, anybody who grew up post-World War II, lived in this incredibly stable time period when it comes to the economy. Yes, there was times where the stock market, you know, crashed like in 2008. But generally speaking, you know, the world order has been fairly stable. If you lived prior to World War II, there were catastrophic events that are so hard to imagine now that, like having your money in the stock market, you could have been wiped out forever. And, you know, in 2008, absolutely, a lot of people lost everything, and we almost lost our business, and it was really bad time. But there was a lot of government support that came in and stabilized things and whatnot. And so I guess my point is, when you think about diversification, sometimes you can sort of have this time bias of like, well, in the last 30 years or 50 years, you know, the stock market's always, it's gone down, but it came back 2 years later. It's always been relatively safe. When in reality, if you look, you know, 100 years or more, you do need that true diversification of, you know, your own operating business or real estate or whatever it may be, because, you know, the world's going to change.
Yeah.
And it's going to keep changing.
But what I find interesting in what you just said is that who talks about 100 years out?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we talk in 5, 10, 25. One of the most beautiful things about being part of a family business is that we have that 100-year out view.
Yeah.
And that is part of the culture. And when you get to second and third generation, and the magic of fourth and fifth is that we have a history of 100 years as opposed to just thinking about 100 years because we're going to keep having babies and make new things happen. So I think that is, I mean, we do the reading around family business, and of course they say that's one of the biggest strengths because we do have that long-term vision.
Yeah, absolutely.
But to have the long-term vision from before and now have it after in my mind, a golden nugget.
No, absolutely. That's a really good point. And, you know, being in G2, our history is only 50 years old
right?
So, you know, that's still a long time, but
sure is.
Being in G4 or G5, that's a whole other perspective.
Yeah, that's right.
So RA's tenacity, and I read an excerpt from what I believe was his biography.
Okay.
And it said that after he passed away, somebody was going through his office and found a poem.
Yeah.
And as a little gift, thank you, I just was wondering if you were aware of this poem and if you could maybe just read it so our viewers could hear it.
I would love to. I am aware of this poem. It has been sketched in my own, I would say, business vision book for a very long time.
Oh, really? Oh, cool.
And what I find interesting is that today, as I was reviewing some of the information for you, I found it again, and I sent it to my family. And
no way.
Thought of the day, because that's part of my role, which I'm sure we're going to get into.
Yeah.
I'd love to read it. So yes, after he died, they were going through his belongings in his desk, and they found this little piece of paper cut out from either a magazine or a newspaper, and they had no idea where it came from. And it says, "Don't quit. Success is failure turned inside out. The silver tint of clouds of doubt. And you never can tell how close you are. It may be near when it seems afar. So stick to the fight when you're the hardest hit. It's when things seem worst. You must not quit."
Yeah.
So beautiful.
It is. And so true.
And so true.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And I used to see stuff like, you know, a quote like that or something when I was younger, and I couldn't really understand how true of a statement that was. Like, you know, don't quit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I read this the other day, I was like, man, that is an incredible, I got to put that on my desk or something like that, because it's so, when you talk to entrepreneurs or family members that have, you know, in a legacy business, they have always had so many ebbs and flows of like nearly losing everything and then they push through it or they rebuild, et cetera. And it's so easy sometimes to look at things, you know, 2020 hindsight and say, oh, it was smooth sailing. But the level of tenacity it must have taken for him to have built those two businesses, you know, the Apple business and then the power company, and sell it and invest it. and then lose everything.
Yep.
And then rebuild.
Again.
Is insane.
Yeah.
Like that would break 99% of people.
And it does.
Yeah.
You know, very few people make it through. And two things I love about this is that, you know, we talk about success and failure as, you know, an upside and a downside, or, you know, to flip the view. But he talks about it, or whomever wrote this, talked about turning it inside out. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's quite powerful. Mm-hmm. I'm quite self-reflective. I believe in really understanding one's own identity and own self in order to know how to serve.
Yeah.
So I love that aspect. And I love it when it says, maybe near when it seems far. Mm-hmm. So there's this questioning, how close am I to it? I'll never really know. And especially if it seems far away, it could be just around the corner.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's a different kind of hope for me.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Thank you for that.
Absolutely. So, incredible history, incredible entrepreneur and founder. How has the business evolved since the days of RA leading it?
Yeah. We were really fortunate to have very smart, dedicated leaders in our family from the very beginning. So whether that was entrepreneurship, which we did have some. So my father's generation, well, RA's son took over, and then that was G2. My father and two of his cousins stepped in when the time was right and started to lead. And of course, each of those generations, there was a different way of doing business, a different interest, a different strategy. Do we diversify now? How do we do that? So we've had, almost 100 years, we've had such a different view. And then, of course, when my father's generation was starting to welcome in my generation, there was the question, you know, how do you see things and what do you want? And so every generation has a different set of values, a different view, a world view. And so it's changed so much that that's a whole other book.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's pretty incredible that you've been around for this long and managed through all those different generations. And I'm always trying to, when I meet a person like you, look at my own family and figure out sort of, you know, where do we go from here, et cetera. So I guess maybe the next question is, do you have a formal family office structure?
Right. So I have two answers to that. I have yes and I have no.
Yeah.
So we do have what we call a family assembly.
Okay.
And we also have what's called an partially embedded family office. So the typical form of a family office can be serviced within, you know, an operating company or a holding company, or you can use services outside, which I'm sure a lot of your viewers know about. We have a mix. So we have a head office that deals with some of the things for the family. And then we also use outside advisors, depending on what kind of work we need to do.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Our formal structure is, we started with a family council. So about 10 years ago, we had a restructuring of the wealth of the family. They call that a pruning of the family tree. And which we had done really in the same spirit of which my great-grandfather ran his business. So it's taking care of everybody, making sure things are equal and fair so that people can be set up to do what they need to do based on their own values and what their dreams are. So after that restructuring, we received great guidance from our advisors. One of them was to set up a formal family council, which was an organization of the shareholders in which to identify our values, what our big dreams are, where we want to see the family to go, and to give guidance to our board of directors. And then we quickly found out that at that point, there were three generations sitting around the table. We found out that there were some people who wanted to do that work. And there were some people who were not really that interested, and they had interests outside of the business that we also wanted to support so that they didn't feel pressure to have to do that. So we restructured and turned our family council into a working executive group. And then we had a family assembly, which included all shareholders, including spouses and children of age that could sit around that table.
I think that's pretty incredible that, first of all, that you were able to do this restructuring, as you called it, successfully. We went through something similar where, you know, basically to get better alignment on where my part of the family wanted to go, we restructured. And, you know, now it's just my parents and me and my brother, which makes it a lot more simple rather than having, you know, uncles and cousins involved.
Yeah.
So I appreciate absolutely how complex that can be. But then sounds like you then had to restructure almost right afterwards to sort of figure out, okay, this isn't working as a council, so let's do it actually as two separate groups.
Yeah.
What was that process like?
Yeah, it was really interesting because, you know, we were those of us who wanted to stay in the business and those of us, you know, who were really committed. So, you know, certain businesses went to one family, other family members said, I don't want to be in family business. I just want to be family with you. They had left. And so those of us who were left in our family branch were, you know, I would say impassioned for sure. Mm-hmm. And we're like, okay, this is it. This is, we want to make this work. These are the businesses we want to be in. We're all in it together. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And to be an active, educated, participatory shareholder, a lot is asked of you. Mm-hmm. And I think we underestimated that. Mm-hmm. And then realized that not everybody wanted to or had the time, because a lot of people had careers. Mm-hmm. They had families, they were raising families. And so to make that shift, it was like, okay, how can we do this in a way where the people who want to participate can, mm-hmm. and the ones who still want to know what's going on, but just don't have the time, you know, to do the legwork to also feel included. Mm. And it was really, if I'm to look back on it, I would say it's part of our DNA, mm-hmm. of being together as a family that never went away. And so those branch members that decided to stay together, that was really strong in our DNA.
Mm-hmm. No, it's incredible. So you spoke at the start about your role sort of at a high level.
Yeah.
I understand what your role is, but for the viewers or the listeners, could you explain a bit about what do you focus on within your current role in the family business?
Okay. So we have, as part of the family assembly, which is the whole shareholder group, we have specific roles for those who want to do more. And my current role is chairperson of the family assembly. We have a vice chair, a secretary, and members at large who do some more of the work. And my role as chair ultimately is, if I were to talk outside of family business, I would call it investor relations, which is my background.
Yeah, absolutely.
The investors just happen to be my sister and cousins and aunts and uncles and, you know, mom and dad. And so ultimately my job as I see it is in communications.
Yep.
And it is to feed the information from the operations, from the board to the family, and from the family and what we want and where we see the company going back to the board and back to ultimately our CEO.
And how many family members are there in total?
That sit around the table, there are 18.
18. Okay. Yep. That's a lot. It's a lot of investors to be chatting with.
That's right.
So I, on a much smaller scale, can absolutely appreciate the complexity of that. I mean, dealing with, as you called it, investor relations, that's complex enough.
Sure.
But then layering on the family dynamics, that's a whole other, aspect. So it's very, very impressive that that's what you do day in, day out.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly important because, as we've talked about before, that engagement and that connectivity and people feeling like they have a voice or they have a seat at the table, that's what keeps, you know, conflict down and keeps the family together.
Absolutely.
And when, in my, you know, opinion or my experience, if people feel like they're being kept out of the loop, that's when resentment builds and things can sort of blow up. So the role you have is one of the most important roles to the longevity of the family. It's pretty incredible.
I absolutely agree with that. And I'm fortunate, I think, that before we had our restructuring, because people's values were different and how they wanted to do business was different, and then business was done differently without other people knowing, there was a lack of trust. So we knew when we did the restructuring and we came together, we said one of the things we have to work on as a family unit is to build that trust again, because that had already degraded enough that led to, you know, the change. And so we said, how our priority is to do that. How do we do that? So a formal structure of communication, people who are responsible for disseminating that information, what are the lines of communication, policies and procedures for transparency's sake. We put a lot of effort into our governance model so that we have a foundation of trust. Because once we have that, then we can move quickly. Then the hard conversations become easier, that we can make decisions a lot faster, and we can be more strategic. And so trust was the motivating, I would say, the motivating factor.
I mean, that's the most important thing. If you don't know, I mean, that's the benefit of family. Is usually the trust level is so high, but then when it goes the other way, it obviously goes very quickly. So so I guess the next question I have is, you have this family assembly, is that what it's called? So you have the family assembly, and then you have, and what's the other layer called?
The family council.
The family council.
Like an executive.
Okay, so the executive group. And so that is a group that is directly interfacing with the businesses, basically?
No. So ours is, so sometimes that's true. So we, we're unique. Our family is unique in that we have no member of the family working in the family business.
Okay.
So no one's in operations, no one's in management. We are only on the governance side. We have family members who sit on the board of directors. And we have, of course, our family members that sit around the assembly table. But our job is all on the governance structure. So setting the vision, the mission, and then putting the structures in place to work on our most important job, which is to populate the board with the best of the best to make the decisions we need to make to support the CEO.
And how long has it been since a family member was in the business day to day?
My father was the last family member to work in the management of full-time, so G3. Now, G4s have worked in the family business, and G5s have worked in the business as well, mostly in summer positions, taking on work terms for co-op programs, but no one has set a career in the family business at this point.
And so, but there is no rule explicitly keeping people out, or is there?
There... by rule, like a policy or procedure that says there will be no family members working the business? No. However, when we talked earlier about culture change, there are some upsides to having family members working in the business. And we had an unspoken culture in our family of what I would suggest is reverse nepotism. So there was never a fear that a family member was going to be brought in to work for the business that wasn't qualified or you know, was a favor, or you know, we were sort of encouraged in the other direction. So go out, go work somewhere else, get the experience. But we also didn't have that pull back. So there wasn't do it to come home, go learn to bring it back to us, go try it out and bring back the secrets. So I think culturally, we kind of missed the boat for my generation. We have highly educated, smart, dedicated, energetic G4s who went off and did MBAs and went to business school and ran their own businesses and were entrepreneurs. But there wasn't a pullback. So I kind of look at our, you know, next step in our assembly is to look at how do we let G5s know that it's also it's important to get educated, because that's our culture of family, but also to get educated to come back if that works for you and if that's something you're interested in. And so I never really received the message that there's going to be a place for you. You should come home. It was kind of a fight back in.
Interesting. Yeah. It's funny how every family business you speak to, it's completely different.
Yes.
And as an example, a person I interviewed recently, they had no choice. it was like expected from a young age. Right. Now, luckily, the gentleman I was interviewing, a friend of mine, he wanted to do it.
Right.
So it was okay. But it, like he spoke about, you know, the what he had heard from his uncles and stuff. And like there was no option. You were going into the family business. Yeah. You did get to do a sabbatical outside and then sort of come back in. But it was, you know, if you didn't want to be in that business, I mean, that that could be a pretty devastating dynamic to have with the family, I'm sure.
And I think that's the thing. You know, we think about, you know, why? I guess my question is, why did that happen? And I could make some guesses. I don't know for sure. But my, you know, I suspect that there were some of my father's generation, it was expected of them. And so because of that, maybe that generation was like, well, we're not going to expect that of our children. And so therefore, we're not even going to put any pressure on them. Mm-hmm. So it's less about what the right answer is and more about, well, why have we made these decisions in the past? Can we be awake in these choices? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the balance that we're playing right now. How do we say that there's this great opportunity, mm-hmm. that this long history of business in across Canada, really, and in the States now, we have this great history that you could be a part of, mm-hmm. if you want, mm-hmm. and here's a path to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think there are some great stories of family businesses who have been very successful.
Absolutely.
And so we're looking to those families to sort of repeat what they've done and implement the employment policies and encouragement of that next generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think last time we spoke, you actually brought up how it resonates with the team members too. You know, your employees love seeing the family around.
They do.
And, you know, I in a separate video, I was doing some research on, you know, is family business a force for good, was the episode. And one of the things that I researched was about how much higher trust and retention was with family businesses, yes. versus with either publicly run organizations or with basically private corporate organizations. And it was significant how much, you know, in general, people trusted if a family was in charge versus sort of a faceless organization.
Absolutely.
So I can totally see the value of having that integration of family members.
Absolutely. And then, you know, I look at my father, George Bishop, who walked the factory floors every day, mm-hmm. and you know, would see where the brooms were and talk to the people, you know, who were on the line and, you know, checked in on their families and his, you know, his uncle did before him and his grandfather did before him. And so the tricky part is how do we, you know, my generation who doesn't, you know, we don't work in the business, how do we show up to the proverbial factory floor?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's doing that. I've just come back from Rexdale, Ontario at CKF and walked around our factory there and it's in great shape. And the employees there are so proud to be there and to show the work that they, you know, these are long shifts and people work so hard, mm-hmm. and they have dedicated not only themselves, but their family members. So we have families working for our family, fathers, you know, daughters, mm-hmm. and their daughters or their sons are coming through. So there's something, you know, the trust is there. The wanting to work for a family business, I can see. So families working for families is a really strong chain, I think.
For sure. Well, it's a lot more human, right?
Yes.
As you know, you can look at the person, you know, and understand who you're working for.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's just, there's a lot more belief that there will be those values, you know, that trickle down and that integrity. So,
exactly.
So,
exactly.
Yeah. No, 100%. So, speaking of the family office and, you know, the complexity of your role, one of the things we spoke about before was that engagement of the family and making sure people, you know, feel that they're included, et cetera. What advice would you have for people, you know, in my position or people that are thinking about, hey, maybe they're in their third generation, but there is no formal structure and they're trying to get alignment or trying to pull their family together. What have you found that works to actually get that alignment of your family?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. Well, first, my gut in this moment is saying to get the alignment and to keep the alignment. I mean, there's something around, and I think because we're all human and we change. I think it's developing those lines of communication that you know, and to set the framework of, you can say whatever you want to say, and I will deeply listen, and then to take the time to sort of process it together. This is what I think I hear you saying. Mm. So a real understanding of the flow of you know, what, you know, ultimately what's in your heart and your gut, and what's in my heart and my gut, and how do we really feel? And then where are we aligned in this, and where aren't we aligned, and what do we do with that? And partly that comes from having the structures in place. So one of the first documents we put together for our model was a family charter, which laid out who would be the members of the family assembly. When do you get to step onto the family or sit around the family assembly table? How old do you get to be? Are there any qualifications? Can spouses be included? Do you have to be a shareholder or like owning shares versus, you know, I may not own shares yet, but I am the daughter of someone who does. And so we set that whole framework. It was one of the best pieces of advice we received. And we have gone through two iterations of that charter. It's meant to be a working document. And I go back to it, especially as chair, frequently to say, how do we do that again? How do we bring somebody new on?
Yep.
And I used it the other day. We have my new family member who is their children are getting older now. They have more time to give, highly educated, MBA, but has been staying at home and looking after her family, and said, yeah, I'm ready now to do a little bit more. And so I have, instead of just saying, yeah, come on aboard to the meeting, maybe we go back through the charter and say, how do we vote somebody on? How is their transparency to make sure all branches of our family see that there's another member? That's one of the tricky parts that we have in our business, is that we do have four family branches that stayed in. And because, we have those four, we're very strong when we're together, and each of the branches have a different, a view and their own culture and their own families.
Yeah.
So giving time to have everybody heard, number one, and to make sure the systems are in place when someone does say, I want this, or it's like, well, let's check. How do we make that happen? How do we make it fair?
Yeah. And I think that's it. What I was thinking was fairness.
Yeah.
Is You do, and to be honest, it's not dissimilar from a business. You want to treat everybody firm but fair, or however you want to describe it. Where as long as everybody's being treated equally, then that's the fairest way to do it.
That's right.
And the idea of a charter is a great idea, because then you sort of get agreement on what does that look like. But to your point, and you referenced it multiple times, culture evolves over time. So you need to have it as a working document.
That's right.
As the next generation gets older, as people come and go, whatever, you have to evolve that to reflect how the overall family feels and how, then they'll believe in it and support it.
I love that. And believe in it. That's the thing. I mean, do you ever watch Ted Lasso?
Yeah.
So good, right? And it's like you have to believe. And that's this kind of don't quit thing is also about believing. And at the end of the day, do I believe in it? And if I were to go around the table of our family assembly and ask each member, I could pretty much bet that they would say, yes, we absolutely believe. What you believe in could be different, which makes it perfect. I mean, we need different beliefs, but to believe in something alone does bring us all together. It's like, okay, we are definitely for this. How do we work through the things that are maybe a bit more complicated, or we don't necessarily agree on that exact, maybe we thought we needed a board member that, came from this background or this background, and how do we actually, how do we pick and choose that together? We do believe in good governance, which I think is the key, having the right leaders in the right seats, making the right decisions. So that's helpful.
For sure. And so building on what keeps you unified, how about as far as engagement? So trying to, maybe there's some family members that are not as interested, or maybe there's some family members that are shy or don't have the confidence, et cetera. What do you do in order to, sort of pull people in or educate people or get people involved, I guess?
Yeah, that's an That's a golden question. I wish you would ask that of everyone so I could hear their answers.
For sure.
I would say you really have to do a self-check. Do we really believe that we want everyone around the table? Because mm-hmm. I get the sense from some other colleagues who are in family businesses that they don't care if their family is around the table or not. Mm-hmm. I would say, if I could speak for the culture of our family, we really believe in the strength of each other. We've grown up that way. It's in our DNA. Mm-hmm. I think I mentioned that. If it's true we all want to be together, it's also true that we all can't be together in the same way. Mm-hmm. And so really getting clear on where people are in their own family units, mm-hmm. what support do they need to get the information to be active and valuable shareholders, but also to support them in their own family units, because mm-hmm. it is a we are a business family, mm-hmm. and we are a family business. We are both. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, it is family.
Yeah.
And so how we keep people involved? Well, we definitely include everyone. So we include spouses and shareholders. We give opportunities for everyone to participate in the way they want. So if someone says, I can't come to that meeting because I have this, we really don't try and make anyone feel guilty about it. It's like, mm-hmm. it's completely understandable. I would say sometimes overly accommodate people's schedules. And that's probably just the part of me trying to get everyone together on a doodle to make sure that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, 18 people.
It's a lot. It's a lot.
Craziness.
Right. And so then we have to rely on our systems again to say, okay, well, we need quorum. We don't need everybody, but we need quorum, which means we need a representative from each of the branches and we need, these things. And then we have different committees that are working on different things. We have a continuity committee that's responsible for making sure we have people in the hopper that are going to be positioned on our board or sit on committees on the board. We have an education committee that they're responsible for setting up the framework of bringing people in to teach us about mm-hmm. things that we don't know about. And also looking to the next generation, how do we more formalize the process of educating them at their level? Mm. So we have great kids, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 years old. And what can we provide for them that's not over their head in their ability to understand business, but also include them to see how special it really is and, what does mom do every day?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you are taking the harder path, and you talk about these other families that, they don't really care if people are sitting around the table.
Yeah.
I can understand why, because, coming from a large family, like, it has a lot of complexity to it, especially around decision making, et cetera. But it is the most important thing, is staying together. And so I think it's truly honorable, the path that you are taking and your family overall is, there's a lot of complexity to what you're saying.
Yes.
But it's for the most important outcome possible, which is keeping your family together. Mm-hmm. And that makes it worth it.
It's so true. And I would say when we did do the pruning of the family tree, it was an interesting mix of people who said they wanted to stay in with these businesses under this leadership, mm-hmm. under my father's leadership. And it wasn't all branch aligned. So it wasn't one branch leaving and another branch leaving and our branch staying. Members from all the branches kind of came together, mm-hmm. which said that we do believe that family is important. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we knew that we were getting ourselves into, as you say, a very complex situation, but we were highly dedicated to it. Mm-hmm. And when the conversation gets tricky around the table, which it does, and it gets heated, which it does, we all know that family matters and that whether we take it personally or not, we can really step back afterwards and say, wow, what's most important is that I connect. So there'll be times when things are said around the table and then I'll get an email a couple of days later and said, when I was saying that, I didn't really mean that. I'm like, I totally know. Mm-hmm. It was a great discussion. We need differentiating views and to really value conflict as an asset. And I think we do that. I mean, we've matured, and we're learning to do it better.
Yeah. No, 100%. I mean, having devil's advocates at the table mm-hmm. is so valuable, yeah. right? Because, and I think you said this well earlier about people need to know what their roles are and, you know, there needs to be good structure set up. There needs to be, people need to understand how the family, you know, operates, et cetera. Because when you're at, you know, a board meeting or you're at one of these meetings, conflict's okay because you want different opinions. You don't want everybody in groupthink mode.
Exactly.
That's the worst thing possible.
Yeah.
But at the same time, conflict's okay, but it should never be personal. You know, it's, we have two different points of view, let's debate them, et cetera. But then when you leave, you don't want that impacting your, you know, family relationship, right? So
when that's why it's harder, right? It's yeah. harder to do in family business, not to take it personally, because it's when, you know, when it's your aunt or your uncle or your father, mm. you know, saying something, it stings a little more than mm-hmm. it would be if it were just your boss.
And, yep.
and I think, you know, we had talked about, you know, some of the questions you were asking me around getting experience outside of the family business before coming in. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we really do believe that's important mm. Because you get to practice those things mm. outside of family and then yeah. you can come back. If I'm comfortable with my own conflict style,
yep.
then at least I can own it as a strength.
Yeah, yeah.
I can take the devil's advocate, or I can take the opposing view for the sake of and have the argument with my uncle, for example,
yeah.
and provide value through it.
Absolutely.
Without taking it personally.
Yeah. And it takes time to build up that, you know, that callus or whatever you want to call it, to have it not immediately elicit an emotional response, right? Like you have to have received tough feedback enough times
yes.
to appreciate, first of all, how to give it so that it's not offensive to others, but also so that you don't overreact yourself. So,
yeah.
Yeah, no, 100%.
And then there's the whole other side where, you know, understanding your own conflict style, it's, I'm just not going to say anything because I don't want to rock the boat, or I am taking it personally, or, and so we miss out on that value as well. Mm-hmm. You know, if you are opposed, if you are upset, if you, you know, you can share that too, which I think, and, you know, maybe I don't have the most amount of experience around it, but sitting around when people aren't as transparent about their emotions, family business allows emotions to be true and valuable. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we can have the table is far more interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things I wanted to go back to, you mentioned it a couple times, was spouses are at the table too. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very rare thing to hear from other family businesses I've spoken to. And I think it's rare because it's complex. You know, you're bringing in people that are not part of the bloodline. Yeah. And, you know, not that adding kids is simple, but it's a little bit more understandable sometimes. And I think it's really important to have spouses involved. I'm fully supportive of it. But I also appreciate that it is sometimes rare for that to happen. Can you talk a bit about what that is like? Because I know that it sounds like it's something you recognize the value of and also the difficulty of doing it properly.
Yeah, yeah. I think for me, I was brought up in a family where my father would come home from the office. We would all sit down at the dinner table. We would talk about business. And my mom was 100% supportive of my dad. And I know that she was his confidant and still is his confidant in life. And so there was something in our culture that valued that kind of support from spouses.
Mm-hmm.
I heard it was the same way the generation before. Mm-hmm. And even the generation, RA's generation with his wife, and she was in most of the photos of him and the big celebrations and successes, and so I think it's part of our culture that spouses always provided value.
Mm-hmm.
To keep that in a time where marriages don't last as long,
mm-hmm.
Where there is concern around, you know, is this person going to be around for, you know, this length of time? I think we're working with concerns around, you know, do we need to consider that? What is that about?
Yeah.
And I can, you know, proudly say that my generation has included spouses in a way where they have provided significant impact, you know, on the success of our shareholder group. I mean, we have a married in who is leading our education committee, highly intelligent, vivacious, very powerful. You know, she has two young sons, and she is taking on a leadership position. Another married in is highly involved. She's been chair of the family assembly before. She sits on the executive team on the family council. She is a part of actually some of the operations work that we do around our scholarship committees. We have scholarships that we give away, and she's heavily involved in that. So that value, I think, is going to continue. We need to be conscious of sort of what's happening in the world, that worldview around what does marriage mean? Do you have to be married?
Yeah, yeah.
Can you be a long-term partner?
Yep.
You know, we already say you don't have to be a shareholder in order to sit around that table, but you do have to be a family member. And our charter identifies what that is.
I mean, the devil's in the details.
Sure is.
And it's the, I'm sure, sometimes uncomfortable part of it is you need to think through these concerns because we don't know what's going to happen in the future, right? But again, it's the harder path. And I really applaud you for going down that road because I know how, again, you know, you hear stories about spouses being kept in the dark and that also causing, you know, a distrust or things. And then they're in the ear of their spouse who's, you know, in the know, but they can sort of turn them against the rest of the family, et cetera. So it goes back to that trust circle and sort of keeping everybody included, making sure people feel they have that voice, et cetera. I think that is such a important, you know, thread to keep your family aligned.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And also too, you mentioned earlier too, that group think, I mean, there is a certain, you know, lineage we come from and the people who are marrying into the family can see it a little clearer than we can see it sometimes. And they can be that other, you know, that mirrors that, you know, this, you guys have kind of been doing it this way. And so we sort of have a really nice flow into, you know, into, I would say, a diversification of shareholders.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm just going to quickly check time here.
Yeah.
So last question for this first section. Where do you hope the family office and the family business will be in 10 years from now?
I hope. And this is a personal hope, I'm not speaking for the rest of the family, that we have more structures in place, that we have more procedures, that there's clarity around how to be involved, how to support the next generation. You know, if someone shows up and they want, you know, this idea of entrepreneurship and they want to use the resources of the business to do something that's completely separate, that wouldn't be in alignment with our, you know, our strategy, long-term strategy, but we could still support family. My hope is to figure out how to extend the tentacles out to really support family as family, whatever it is they want to do, because we have a wealth, both of heart and of finances that can help people's lives. And we have really smart people who want to do great things in the world. And whether it's in alignment with our operations or not, I my big dream is that we can support those family members who want to do that.
That's an honorable dream. I'm Luke Hanson-McDonald. This was Beyond the Family Business. Please review and subscribe. Thank you very much. Talk to you next time.